Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, we're heading out to the Pacific Islands today to visit Samoa with author Maya Lynch. She spent the better part of a week deep in the jungles of a very old portion of Samoa to locate the ruins of a unknown people. And it's quite a story that she writes in her book. Hey, we're also checking in with Eric Von Doniggan. He has some amazing footage from about 20 years ago when he climbed down underneath the Great Pyramid of Cheops in Egypt and found a number of sarcophaguses and also running water under the pyramid. So a lot of interesting things to talk about today, plus some special material too. So here is the show. Saturday, September 16, 2017. This is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. How you doing? How are you? You know, we're almost at the end of summer. Autumn begins on the 22nd, which is a week from this. Well, it's next Friday, actually, the 22nd of September. What did you do this summer? Did you go anywhere? I mean, I've been talking about getting out and doing stuff in the summertime, and it's funny. We're so busy in our lives that weeks and months just go by with the blink of an eye. And before you know it, summer has ended. And I'll tell you why I'm reminded of summer, the end of summer, is that the first day of Oktoberfest begins September 22nd, the first day of autumn. And that is where people go beer crazy in Munich and other parts of the world. And out here in San Francisco, we have an Oktoberfest by the bay. And I've been doing it with a group of friends for the last decade. And I went out and bought a pair of Lederhosen. And so I wear the traditional cowhide shorts with the suspenders. I have the official shirt, and I have shoes and socks and everything like that. And we sit and we go to a huge beer garden. Well, out here in San Francisco, a beer garden is a pier that was built in the 1920s. And it's converted to a long building. On top of a pier, right on the water, on the bay. And on the interior, they hang these massive flags. They bring in the picnic benches. They have a huge stage where a 27-piece Oompa band plays. And the space is so big, and they serve so much beer that they drive these trucks in, which are filled with kegs of various kinds of Marzen, which is a holiday beer, German Oktoberfest beer, lighter beers, and then they get barbecues going. We get the courses has to be sausage, pork. For those who don't eat meat, they have veggie dogs and things like that. But it's a total party. We have a blast. It's funny because when it first started, it was always kind of fun, but as it grew, after about the second or third year, you know, it's a 3-day event. We go on Friday night because Saturday's a little crazy, but you know, each day there's 5,000 people that crowd into this giant beer garden. So we have a blast. So happy Oktoberfest to you, those of you who are German and who celebrate it. And remember, that's the first day of August, next Friday the 22nd. Hey, the results are finally in. I have been dealing with a strange earache for months, constant ache in the ear, went to Chinese medical doctors. I talked about it just before I went to my trip to Paris in Europe last December into January. I was dealing with this weird earache, and had herbs, had acupuncture, did a whole routine of ear drops, and I thought I had it licked. You know, I was going, it's over with, but it kept coming back. And, you know, I went to the doctor. Finally, he made a suggestion. You know, that was it. He said that it could be related to my teeth. And as it turns out, I have all my wisdom teeth. Two are my uppers are not exposed, or what they call erupted, but the ones on the bottom are partially exposed. And on the right side, it looks like that is the culprit. And, you know, it kind of blows me away to think about, here is a tooth that is affecting my ear. I still can't figure it out, but I mean, it all has to do with nerves. So I'm going to bite the bullet and have that tooth removed. I'm not looking forward to that. Hey, but the good thing is it's not impacted. It's almost about half erupted. It's half exposed. And so I'm crossing my fingers. It's a 1-2-3 procedure. I have to go in and see the oral surgeon. And probably most of you that are listening, or many of you, are going, yeah, hey, I went through that too, dude. So it's not a big deal. Or maybe it is. I mean, my cousin did it 5 or 6 years ago, and I think they had to knock her out or something. So I don't know why I'm laughing. But anyhow, extraction. It's time for the extraction. So the tooth has to come out, and I'm hoping this does it, because, I mean, I get out and hike a lot, and I have to cover that ear because it's so sensitive. So I'm crossing my fingers that will be the solution. That will be it. No more problems with the ear. So, yeah. Hey, this coming week, I'm introducing a new series called Earth Ancients Special Edition. And this is a program that will air Wednesday the 20th. And the first program features author Colleen Morrow, and she has written a book called Spiritual Telepathy. And one of the reasons that I'm introducing this is there is a new group of authors, intuitives, people that are very sensitive to subtle energy, who are presenting works from ancient teachings. These are teachings that help us access wisdom on higher levels. These are in-depth programs, and these shows will provide you tools and techniques to reconnect with some of these higher levels that the ancients did. And some of it involves light meditative states, and she'll provide guided meditations. People for years thought this was like really woo-woo stuff. As some of you might know, I've been meditating for over 20 years. And so some of this stuff comes to me, but these are techniques that the Greeks, the Hindus, and Maya, and a lot of early cultures used for daily clarity. And what's really interesting is it helps you connect with the higher realms. And there's energies, there's consciousnesses, and there's you might even consider them higher beings that are there to assist us. So these people that I'll bring on to this special edition, and I'll do it once a month or maybe twice a month midweek, these shows are designed to help us access levels of consciousness. Now, this is all new. This is all new stuff. Some people in the old, you know, medieval times would be burned at the stake for presenting this kind of material because, you know, it's considered paganism. It can be considered witchcraft, but hey, we're in a modern era. All those days are over, and we are now entering a time when we're ready for this type of information. Hey, and if you're not into it, just, you know, skip it. Wait till Saturday's regular show, which is always interesting, of course. But these midweek programs, these special editions, are featured, you know, a couple times a month. Next Wednesday is the first of a series on spiritual telepathy, tapping into the ancient wisdoms. And these wisdoms are coming back. They're coming back, and we need to use them. So I think you're going to find it quite interesting. So join us next week.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Hey, and if you're not familiar with the Earth Ancients News, it's mostly posted on the Facebook page, which automatically gets populated onto the Earth Ancients website. So if you're not into Facebook, just go to earthancients.com, go to the Facebook feed area, and you'll see all the details and information that I speak about each week. Author Richard Cassero, we know Rich from his interviews and from his books, has posted a very large gallery of megalithic stone buildings and chambers in the New England area. These are chambers that a lot of people don't know about. They're in Vermont, Connecticut, New Hampshire. I think he's even got one or two in upstate New York. These are massive monolithic stone buildings that were discovered by the colonists in the 1700s. And we've had a number of authors speak about these stone buildings, and some of them are thousands and thousands of years old. But he actually shows a gallery. It's probably, let me see here, it's over 40 photographs of these very unusual buildings. Actually, a lot of them are sitting on top of geomagnetic fields. John Burke, the one I talk about quite a bit, did field research and measured the energetics in a lot of these buildings. So, and this is really nice because I've never seen so many, and Rich does a really good job photographing them and giving us a good idea of, you know, just a few of probably hundreds of these stone chambers and buildings. In October, we'll be speaking with author Melanie Zimmer, who has written a book called Finger Lakes, the Curious Nature of Finger Lakes, which is upstate New York. And apparently there's petroglyphs and unusual anomalous stone carvings, some smaller megaliths that she has chronicled in her book, Finger Lakes. So stay tuned for that in October. That's just a side note to Richard's gallery. Hey, a pyramid culture has been identified off the coast of Africa. It's the Mauritius Island, and these are stone pyramids that have been identified. Apparently, they don't know how old they are, but they're perfectly formed. There's at least 12 of them. Some of them are small. Some of them are very, very, very large. This is something that I didn't know about. I'm going to look into this a little more and see if I can find somebody who's done any research in that area. But off the coast of Africa, they are clusters of these pyramids. And from the photographs that you can see on the Facebook page, actually, there's a video that I posted where they actually fly over a few of them, but there's mostly still photographs from a few years ago. I actually had somebody email me, said that they had been there a few years ago, and that they actually climbed on them, which is kind of interesting. Scientists are taking a closer look at the main pyramid at Chichen Itza, and this is an article I posted by National Geographic. They're actually scanning the outer walls, and they're looking at the inner chambers. Apparently, there's a number of small chambers underneath the main pyramid. Now, remember, Chichen Itza is home to El Castillo, the castle as known by the Spanish. And this pyramid, the outer pyramid, was put up by the Toltec, but there's an inner pyramid and even a smaller pyramid. So there's actually three pyramids. And the original pyramid apparently has some anomalies within it that they're going to take a look at. And they actually open up a section at the very top, and you can see a photograph that I posted where they're lowering a researcher all the way down. It looks like it's about 50 feet into the interior of the pyramid. So check that out. It's the full article on National Geographic. I'm really surprised they're doing that, but I think that they're possibly following up on some of the research that the Mexican Archaeological Society conducted a few years ago. And they, at that time when they were scanning the interior of the pyramid, they discovered that El Castillo sits on top of the cenote, which also has a underwater river running through it. So very, very interesting. And of course, leads us to consider what properties of that pyramid are, what the electromagnetics are. I'd love to have somebody measure it. We're going to be out there October 28th through November 4th as we tour Yucatan. You can find out more about that by going to earthancients.com/tours. We'll talk a little bit more about that in later in the show. I'm going to do some basic measurements while I'm out there, but someone needs to get out there with some serious testing equipment and see what is happening in that pyramid. So there, National Geographic's checking that out. Hey, Evan Strong has posted a new article on what he calls, or what's been determined as, the Australian version of the Stonehenge. There's massive monoliths in special forms. They're circular, and there's some squares. And it's now appears that the site known as Adam's Garden in Australia may have been used for astronomical observations. Some of these stones apparently point to various constellations, and you can see the entire article he wrote for Ancient Origins magazine on the Facebook page, as well as a series of very good photographs that he took of Adam's Garden. And we spoke a little bit to him about that when he was on the program. So check that out. Here's an interesting one. In medieval south of France, a medieval town, a crypt holds the remains of a person rumored to be the famous Mary Magdalene, who was the companion of Jesus. And scientists have done some computer modeling, and they reconstructed the face of a woman who they believe is this actual Mary from the Bible. They're doing more of this kind of computer reconstruction now. We've had a couple of examples on the program. You know, it's hard to believe, you know, because as much as we want to believe that story, is it a true story? Is it not? Is it a fable? Is it whatever, you know? But it's something to consider. And this face, you can see it. You can see her in her full glory on the Facebook page. Also, check it out on earthancients.com. But pretty trippy. I mean, very lifelike. They can actually render a face from a skeleton, you know, exactly how we look today, or how they looked at the time of when they lived. So, wow, that's kind of trippy. So always go to the Facebook page. Each week we have people from around the world who are posting articles. They're posting galleries that they've taken. And as you know, we speak to people everywhere, you know, we cover the globe. So check it out, Earth Ancients. Go to Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to the group page. Also, go to the international page. You'll see a lot of material there, too. Now we're going to check in with Melissa Tittle of Gaia to find out what's going on this week. Hey, we got some interesting updates on the mummy, the Nazca mummy. So I'll be interested to learn what she has to say about that. So here's Melissa. Hey, Okay, so we're checking in with Melissa. She's in the heights of Denver, calling out to the wild. Hey, how are you, Melissa?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Okay, so we got some interesting things happening with Gaia this week. The first thing I want to talk to you about, and this was a total mind blower for me, is that Eric Van Doneghan has a 20-plus minute special, which is a preview, I guess, of some of his work, where he is climbing down below the Great Cheops Pyramid into subchambers. And I mean, when I saw this, I was like, what the heck is this all about? I've never heard of these before. And so talk a little bit about that. I mean, you must have known about it, obviously, because it's in your catalog, but wow, that is very cool.
Yeah, no, it's been very cool. I don't think it's a new concept. I think I haven't seen some of the pictures that he's taken in the video before, so that's really cool. But I don't know if you're familiar with Christopher Dunn. He has a has he come on your show
many
at all?
Many times. Yeah, his book.
Many times. So his whole theory about it being a power plant accesses those subchambers. But I think what's great about Van Daniken kind of going into it is it opens up a bigger question, which a lot of people in this field talk about, which is that there's not just a couple chambers. Like, they go on and on. Like, they connect from the Great Pyramid to the Sphinx, and they have all these other subchambers. Like, underneath the Giza Plateau is actually, according to some people, an old military base, kind of maybe what you would find underground in New Mexico today. Which is maybe not an old military base, but a active military base. but that's really fascinating, and that hasn't been explored. Like, that's just the tip of the iceberg. And I think it's a very interesting, and of course, no one's really been allowed to dig deeper or go further in those chambers, but those pictures and video that he has are pretty fascinating. Kind of,
I don't know
that
how
concept.
He got access to that. I mean, he is actually, there's a photo of him climbing down the stairs, and then he's photographing this river. I'm going, how in the heck did he get permission? Because they're very, very, he must have paid somebody off. I don't know how he got down there. I mean, this is like really unheard of stuff. So anyhow, for those of you listening, it's a great way to check this out. You got to go to Gaia.com/Earth Ancients, and you're going to have to pay your 99 cents to see it. But I did post a photograph of it. I posted the Gaia video on the Facebook page, so check that out. Hey, we want to jump real quickly to the mummy.
All right.
The NASCAP mummy, because some new data has come out that the actual skeleton is actually a skeleton. It hasn't been manipulated. So can you talk a little bit about this latest find?
We're talking about Maria, correct?
Maria,
Maria the big mummy. Yes, and I think I talked about it a little bit last time, but the most amazing thing about these tests that have been done, DNA tests, is that we took samples from the foot and the hands, the feet and the hands, and the body, of course, and we took several samples from the body. So we took a sample from the bottom, we took a sample from the side, and then we took samples, two samples of the feet and two samples of the hand, each hand. And we wanted to see if they matched. And the most important thing is the data came back that they 100% matched. That is amazing, which means that if someone didn't just take a bunch of random bones and stick them together on a human-looking body.
Right.
So that goes into what you said, where the skeleton of this mummy is 100% organic and real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now we have to go through the DNA process of figuring, okay, so we have figured, we've eliminated the fact that it could be any kind of primate, and so now it's going into the human genome. What part of that does it share with what we currently know? and that takes a couple more months. But for me, the results that the hands and the feet match the body's DNA 100% is really fascinating.
I mean, it must be validating for you because this is your, you know, something you've been really attached to for a while now. And one of the early detractors came out and said, you know, they had looked at the hand. I have a couple of people that said this and said, oh, it's made up of different bones. They don't fit right. And here's validation that, hey, this is a naturally occurring, like you say, organic hand. And there's no manipulation. It's a real McCoy. That is a huge piece of evidence. I mean, that is huge. And then at some point, we're going to find out where this person fits in the human evolution. If it's an aberration, anomalous individual, part of a small group, or off planet of some kind, which would be very interesting.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, I'm like I said, I'm from the beginning. I'm trying to stick to the facts before I jump, you know, leap over the shark, jump the shark. You know, I don't think there's any point. I think there's a lot of people that are questioning it. So let's just go with the questioning and figure out what we have. And I think it's really fascinating. I mean, I think I told you in a couple interviews before that I talked to a taxidermist, and I said, okay. Here's the issue. Could somebody take a bunch of random bones and then perfectly meld skin, like melted animal skin or human and animal? I mean, this is really gruesome, but could they do that? And how would they do it? And he like thought about it, and he's like, I might know someone who knows how to do that, but that's not something easy to do, and that's not something a lot of people know how to do. And to melt skin together and not have any seams, that's nearly impossible. And I'm like, okay, well, there's that. So food for thought or skin for thought, whatever you want to, however you want to put it.
Exactly. Right. Okay, cool. Hey, well, we'll keep an eye on that. I'm very curious about what the university finds out regarding the DNA, because that's really the proof. That's the final. I mean, where do you go from there? I mean, at that point, you probably get a research group together and go, okay, who is this being? What are they all about? And then perhaps you go back to the cave and you excavate it a little better. Is that some of the ideas that Gaia is thinking about, or is it beyond? Are you done with all that?
I mean, everything's possible. I think that everything has its time. I think sometimes when things get a lot of excitement, they also stop the process. They stop the investigation.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, you know, people want to know answers. Unfortunately, I think a lot of these things take time when there's not so much press around it or people are upset or excited about it. Sometimes that actually hurts investigations, which is why I think a lot of people that maybe do discover strange things kind of keep it under wraps for some time until they can get all the data.
Right. But, very cool.
But, you know, we didn't really know what we had. So we were like, yeah, let's go shoot it. That sounds good. And
I mean,
but,
you got
but this is exciting
coverage. So, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it is exciting. It's another step, positive step. It's a positive step, to some kind of unveiling, we would think. So, all right. Hey, Melissa, thank you.
Yes.
You have a great weekend, and we'll
you
talk
too.
To you next week. Okay.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Bye.
Bye. So you can see the whole series, the whole Mummy series, on the Gaia website, and they have a real easy way to get on their site. Very, very reasonable. For just 99 cents for the first month, you can see the entire catalog, over 8,500 titles. There's a whole series on this Nazca Peruvian mummy. And to get the deal, go to Gaia. It's GAIA.com/EarthAncients. And, you know, it's not just pyramids and ancient aliens. They have a whole ancient wisdom section. They have a health section. If you've never meditated before, they have a meditation section. It leads you along. They have a yoga program. And they have a ton of stuff from Eric Von Däniken. And it's just tons of stuff. They're our sponsor. We work together just beautifully because we cover a lot of the same stuff. And it's great to have them. So I hope you'll support Gaia. And, hey, just take the loose change out of your pocket. Shoot it through the internet. It's 99 cents for the first month. Go to gaia.com/earthancients. You won't be disappointed. I know you're going to love their stuff. This week, I posted a video by Eric Von Däniken, who explains the depths of the Great Pyramid at Cheops and the underwater river and sanctuary that he discovered over 20 years ago. Eric didn't actually discover it. He actually got permission to travel into the Cheops Pyramid and went below and actually filmed these interior chambers that I have not seen to the level that we see in this Gaia video. Now, the video is not free. You have to sign up, get on there, gaia.com/earthancients and sign up 99 cents. But what I have done is I have pulled off the audio portion, and I want you to hear in his own words what Eric has to say about these inner chambers.
Under the Great Pyramid is a room which is known since eternity. It's called the unfinished chamber. The unfinished chamber, you have a shaft going down, and the shaft is 119 meters long. You have to go down really on your knees because it's only about 1 meter high. And you come to the unfinished chamber. There are no writings, no chiseling, nothing. It's just primitive out of the rock. No one understands why this unfinished chamber is there. It makes no sense. Herodotus, the Greek historian who was there around 450 BC, he said that under the pyramid, there is a lake, a sea, and the sea has absolutely clear water. And in the water, there is a sarcophagus with the remains of some gifts of the god Osiris. One has to know Osiris is the oldest god in Egypt. And Osiris is the same thing which in the firmament is Orion. So Orion and Osiris is the same. Even in writing, in hieroglyphics, it's always said. Now, Herodotus, the Greek historian, says, under the pyramid is a lake with clear water and a sarcophagus with some gifts of Osiris. Archaeologists never took this for true. They said, what is Herodotus telling us? It is impossible that under the pyramid there is a lake, because the pyramid finally is in the Sahara Desert. There's no water, nothing. Some years ago, they found, in fact, the lake under the pyramid. And of course, I was down there. We were climbing down there. First, you come into a small room, and there are stairs, two stairs. Now you go down there, right down in a shaft. The shaft is big enough for two ladders. Of course, the ladders are from our days. Then you come to a small room, which is chiseled out of the rock, inside the rock. And there you see seven niches. But only in two niches are some sarcophaguses. One is made out of black basalt. Basalt is volcanic stone. There are no volcanoes nearby. We don't know why they had to use basalt sarcophagus. And the other one is granite. Now, from this point, you again go deeper, another shaft, into the rock. Now, the first shaft was as large enough for two ladders. The second shaft has only room for one ladder. It's smaller. You have to really, with your elbows, you touch the walls. Then you come under the place, you make a right angle, and you see, in fact, a lake. It's not a big lake. It's some sort of creek with absolutely clear water. And in the water, there is a sarcophagus. We measured the sarcophagus. We made photographs of the sarcophagus. So the Greek writer, historian, was right. He was correct saying that there is a lake under there. Now, modern, today's archaeologists, I asked, what did you find in the sarcophagus? They told me nothing. Now, I don't know if this is the truth or not. But the fact is, the Greek historian Herodotus told us about a lake under the pyramid, and he was right. Also, archaeology for centuries said, this is impossible. The same Greek historian said that the gods came down 11,240 years ago. Now, archaeologists do again not accept the 11,240 years ago, because history of Egypt is roughly 3,000 years B.C., but not 11,000 years B.C. They disagree with Herodotus, but I suggest Herodotus is right, and we are wrong. The pyramid must be much, much older, was constructed before the Great Flood by a technology which Enoch had from the extraterrestrials. The planning, the engineering planning, came from the extraterrestrials. Some of the tools came from the extraterrestrials. The dirty work was done by us, by the humans.
So that's not a really good reproduction, but I pulled it off the video and tried to clean it up. But you can hear what he's saying. I have never seen these rooms before. They're cut out of solid rock. They're perfectly cut. Some kind of machine cut them. And it's Eric's German accent. When he says letters, he means ladders. There's photographs of him in this video of him climbing down these ladders deep, deep, deep underground, deep under the pyramid of the Great Pyramid. And I actually have a promotional video that I posted a couple of days ago of this larger, I think it's a half an hour video that's on the Gaia streaming website. It's just, it gives a few clips of what he's talking about. And there's actually a running creek or river that you can see deep under the Cheops pyramid. So, I mean, I've never seen these rooms before. And I'm really curious how Eric got permission to do this. He's 80 years old. He turns 80 this year. And the level of precision in these chambers is just mind blowing. And I think most of the photographs are at least 20 plus years old. So these are not rooms or information that the general public gets. And I don't think it's ever appeared in any National Geographic magazine. If you want to see the entire video, as well as some of Eric's other videos and programs, go to gaia.com/earthancients. Do it for a month at 99 cents. And if you don't like anything else, then, you know, I would stick around. It's after that's $9. But there is so much content there on the Great Pyramids that it's worth the price of admission. And Gaia seems to be the only company who is filming this and taking this information and making it available to the public. So check it out, gaia.com/earthancients. This week we head to the South Pacific island of Samoa, where we'll travel with a research investigator as she rediscovers a megalithic culture from the ancient past. I think you'll enjoy this. So I hear from different people around the world about ancient populations, different people in the South Pacific. I have friends in Australia who have told me about the outback. We've had authors on our show that have talked about the Aborigines, but we haven't really touched on any of the South Pacific islands, Samoa, and some of the other islands surrounding that area. A number of authors believe that there is, and have written about, evidence of what they believe are the remains of Lemuria, of Mu. We've had Dr. Susan Martinez on the program, who wrote a book about Pan, which is another term for Lemuria. And we have talked with people. David Childress has spoken about his book, his new book on Indonesian pyramid cultures and the ancient people in that area. But our guest today is a research investigator who actually rediscovered the remains of a pyramid culture in Samoa. Her new book is Samoan Pyramid, and I'd like to introduce you to Maya Lynch. And now Maya is coming to us today from New Zealand. She is a trained computer programmer, worked for 20 years in the advertising industry, and she has become a strategist advising politicians on their campaigns, I would imagine. And I got a hold of a couple of pages of this book, The Samoan Pyramid, and I had to get a hold of Maya. And it's really great to have her on the program today. Maya, how are you?
Hey, Cliff, I'm great. Thank you very much for having me on.
Hey, tell us about the work you do. You're a strategist for what, New Zealand politicians, or what does that mean?
Yeah, so I've worked on some political campaigns. I've worked with, like this year, I worked with the Greenpeace guys on a work they did in the Thai fishing industry and how we can trying to make changes in the fishing industry. So I don't know if you know, but like in the fishing industry, there was slavery and everything going on still today, you know. So okay. I got involved with that, and we put some good new rules in place that will kind of stamp that out. So
slavery, yeah. You mean they're forced labor to go fishing?
Yeah. And yeah, yeah. So
what
yeah.
country? Is that New Zealand?
So in the food chain, so basically the largest tuna manufacturer, a company called Thai Union, mm-hmm. Basically it's kind of complex to get into and kind of nerdy, but basically there are fishermen that come to Thailand from Burma and places like that, then they think they're going to be working in the factory, but actually they end up on the ships. And then once the ships leave the port, the fishing boats leave the port, they can be out there for years and never come back to port. And there are boats that go take the fish off those boats, bring that back to port, a thing called drop shipment, a technique called drop shipment. So it was really to kind of stop that practice and also make sure that agents weren't being paid. So some people, they go in the boats and then they owe all their money to an agent that got them the job. So it was putting all those kind of things in place. So yeah,
that's kind of interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me how a Scotswoman, you're born in west coast of Scotland,
yeah, Glasgow,
ends up in New Zealand. How does that happen?
Yeah. Well, it was my partner had come here with work and came home and just raved about it, you know, raved about New Zealand and what a wonderful place it was and how the people were lovely and blah, blah, blah. And I'd lived lots of different places. I knew how good travel is, you know, how good it is for you. And I thought, well, if you like it, let's go and try it. And we just came here for 3 months and then we extended it to 6 months. And then, actually at that point we were going to go home. And then a friend booked a ticket to arrive in New Zealand the day after we were due to leave. So we changed it and stayed another 3 months in it. And then after that, kind of fell in love with the place, you know. It's a beautiful place, Cliff, you know.
I see pictures of it. What? There's some kind of vibe there, some kind of energy that people just talk about. I hear that the people are very uplifting, very positive. But it's just the whole environment there.
Yeah,
appears to be magical, isn't it? Or what would you say? What's compelling?
like any country, it has its problems. And, you know, we have an election going on right now, so and that kind of brings all those problems to the fore. But I mean, nobody's trying to kill you here. You know, that's basically nobody really cares about it. So nobody's trying to blow us up. And that is a very nice thing in today's world, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's beautiful. It's people have only been here for 600 years. You know, it's the last place on Earth to be settled. Yeah. And there were probably some people here a little bit earlier than that, you know, quite a bit earlier than that. But it's a recent population. It's a new country, and there's still a sense of fairness in the people, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a place that you can really settle down and enjoy yourself. And I think the cost of living is a lot less than the United States or the UK.
Oh, so. I wish that was true.
Oh, it isn't. It isn't.
No.
Oh, okay. So it's
no.
What?
It's like the fourth. I think you got London, Melbourne, Sydney, London, New York, Sydney, and then Auckland is the most expensive places to live. So,
Yeah, I know.
It's kind of got out of control in the past few years. So hopefully something will happen this election. You know.
Hey, well, let's talk about this book. I had a chance to read it, The Samoan Pyramid. I really enjoyed it. It's very well written. But
thank you.
You know, I have to ask you, how did you get interested in pyramid cultures in the Pacific? These megalithic these builders, were you researching and you just fell upon it or what? What triggered you to get involved in this?
Yeah, so it was back in 2012 and I'd just come back from Egypt. And have you been to Egypt, Cliff?
You know, I haven't.
You need to go.
It's on my to-do list. But
you definitely need to go there.
Yeah.
Well, I just come back from Egypt and I was kind of... I used to work with this guy who was a video editor, and he worked for National Geographic and Discovery and people like that. So he had this encyclopedic knowledge of the world, you know. Mm. And so one day I was chatting to him about things I'd seen in Egypt, and he suggested I look at these things in Samoa called the Star Mounds. Now, the Star Mounds are they're basically made of stone, piles of stone that are a meter or two high and about 10 meters across and shaped like a star, a starfish, hence the name. Mm-hmm. And so I started looking at those things, and I downloaded a data set because I like to work with data, and looked at some archaeology reports. And and in those reports was this one weird standout in amongst the data. So most of these star mounds are, like I say, are a few meters across, a few meters high, and shaped like a star. And then in the data was this one monument that was 60 meters across, and, you know, the height of a five-story building, and not shaped like a star. It was shaped like a step pyramid. And so I started to wonder at that point, is what on earth are we looking at, and how did it end up in the same data set? Mm-hmm. And so this place was called Pulemelei on the island of Savai. And that got me interested. And so I started digging in to see if I could find anything about this place. And I knew that the government, so in the 1800s, New Zealand planned an invasion of Samoa. And so there's a whole bunch of information from the 1800s in the government records that they gathered about Samoa. So I started digging through that to see if I could find any mention of the place. And I found this crazy mention by a guy called Howard Sterndale, who was a plantation manager. And he said he'd gone into the jungle and seen this thing. He called it I'm just trying to find a quote here. He says, the whole interior exhibits evidence of ancient prosperous settlement, covered with luxuriant forests in whose silent depths are to be seen the ruins of ancient villages and buildings of strange form composed of massive stonework. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because that doesn't sound like a star mound either, you know.
Mm.
And then I kept digging, and I found from the 1840s a mention by this missionary called Reverend John Stair, who was working in Savai, and he said he'd gone into the jungle and seen this thing, which he called a massive construction, which seems to have been the work of an earlier but now extinct race of men. And to be honest with you, that was probably enough. That kind of the data from the archaeology report had this weird standout,
yeah.
And then I had these old reports from the 1800s that described something strange, perhaps built by an earlier but now extinct race of men. And so I started to get kind of obsessed with it from that point.
Good. In your book, you actually discuss Roger Green's book on Samoan archaeology, which I didn't know existed, but that sounds like another good start. And then, of course, you mentioned Stuart Scott's exploration of the Samoan ruins. But, I mean, it must have been a collective of thoughts and readings that made you want to fly to Samoa, because it's funny, in your book, and we're going to talk a little more about this, the locals don't really get into it at all.
And
I want to talk to you about that, but I mean, they don't, I mean, there isn't, you probably, and from your writings, you basically show that there's no references. It's not like a point of reference to go check out. You can't get a paid guide. You have to kind of, you know, find somebody who knows the area. And I find that was quite interesting in your work. So so after you read everything, then you decide, what, I need to go check this out? Or how did it come about?
Yeah, it kind of I did a terrible thing. I wrote on a post-it note, "There's a pyramid in Samoa," and stuck it on my computer screen. And then it just goaded me, you know, for weeks. And eventually I had to give in. I started gathering all this information. But when I booked a flight and off I went, you know. And when I arrived there, I mean, I was completely naive, you know. When I arrived there, I really believed it would be similar to in Egypt. You just turn up, you book a coach tour, and you go there.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And it was just the opposite of that. You know, I went to the tourist office and was told in no uncertain terms that was not a place any Westerner could visit. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, with some prodding, the woman told me a kind of general area on the map where I might be able to find someone that could help me. But I mean, really, there's a great resistance to talking about this pyramid in Samoa. Most people don't even know about it. When you ask anyone in the street about Pulemelei, about the Samoan pyramid, they just look blank, you know. And a lot of people, what happened was I'd ask them, they say, "Oh, I don't know anything about that. I'll ask my grandparents," you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd come back after they'd spoken to their grandparents and say, "No, you can't go there."
Why do you think there is such a resistance in Samoa? I mean, people are almost angry when in your book you describe how people not only are resistant, they're almost like, "How dare you ask me about this?" Is it because they've been somewhat invaded by different older research groups that just kind of walked over them and said, "Hey, we're going to look this over"? Or why do you think there is such resistance to this? What I would think would be kind of a cool place.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, I thought so. I still think so. You know, I think there's many reasons. I mean, so Samoa is it's very Christianized. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's really intensely Christianized. And you know, I'm from Glasgow, so I know I've seen what hard out Christianity does. You know,
yeah.
But Samoa was just next level. You know, and so there was definite Christian opposition to it from the sense that it's pre-Christian and therefore must be demonic. You know, that I heard that more than once, you know.
Okay, there you go.
But there's another reason for it as well, is that in the Samoan folklore, it's the monument has become tapu, and tapu means forbidden. But if you think tapu's the root of the English word taboo, so it's forbidden but also kind of evil, you know. So no Westerners really allowed to go there. And also I think, yeah, definitely the fact that there've been so many researchers that have gone to Samoa in the, you know, during the 20th century, right back to, you know, the 1700s, that that have caused problems, that have imposed a Western theology on a history. And so I can understand why people wouldn't want some random chick just turning up and going in the jungle, you know?
We're going to talk about your journey into the jungle here in a second, but I want to ask you why you feel there is no mythology, no legends, no historical reference to these ruins. I just want to ask what you think, because you don't really talk about it. You basically say there aren't any, but I was just wondering what you discovered when you landed and you began asking around about where this place might be.
Sure. So there's a couple of reasons for that, I think. So it's kind of complex to delve into, but there's two reasons in a nutshell. There was no written word in Samoa until the Europeans arrived, you know. So all written history, the record starts in 1830 with the arrival of the English missionaries. Now there is, when you dig into that story, this guy John Williams from the London Missionary Society arrived in Samoa in the 1830s. It's the biggest arrival story told in Samoa today, you know. Not the story of how the Samoans got to the island, but the story of how John Williams got to the island, you know. He is the hero, and you have to really respect someone that could come from outside and put himself smack bang in the middle of Samoan history so expertly in just a few shrewd moves. But I won't delve too deeply into this, but so John Williams worked for the London Missionary Society. He was living in Tonga, and he did a deal with, there was many different missionary groups. The London Missionary Society, the Catholics were there. There was lots of different missionary groups in the Pacific at the time. No one had managed to make any inroads into Samoa, and really people were scared to go to Samoa. It had a fearsome reputation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So John Williams does this deal with the other missionary groups. He says that if you give me exclusive rights to Samoa, I will give you exclusive rights to Fiji. I won't come after your work in Fiji. You just don't try and do the same in Samoa. So they did that deal. And then he hooks up with this Samoan guy called Fuea. And then they head off from Tonga and they sail to Samoa. Now, Fuea is the cousin of this guy, Malietoa Vainupu. They turn up at Malietoa Vainupu's village and basically declare him the new leader, you know. And Vainupu converts to Christianity, and then churches are built around, 100 churches are built around the island in that first year. And next to every church is a shop, and they sell European goods in the shop. And then in order to pay for those, people start working for the church. The kids start going to school. Within 3 years, 70% of the population have converted to Christianity. Within 7 years, it's more like 98%, you know. So now those missionaries that arrived there were the first ones to record the history, and they recorded the history of Malietoa Vainupu's family. They didn't record the rest of the history. So the story is told from his point of view. You know, the history is told from his point of view. And he didn't say anything about the pyramid, so it never got into history. I'm not really sure why it's not in the myth, but it's just not. It just doesn't appear at all.
That's somewhat sad, because that's fairly recent history that they could have an ancestry that goes further back. But that happens in other cultures. I've seen that. All right, so here you go. You get in, you get your guide, you get Baba, right?
Yeah.
And he tells you, yes, I know where to go. You spend the better part of a day trekking through hot and humid jungles. At one point, you're saying to yourself, I don't think I can do this. It's too much. He's keeping up a pretty good pace.
Yeah.
And one thing leads to another. And you cross the river, and you land, or you find the very early portions of the outer edge of, I guess, a complex is what I'm going to use the term.
Yeah.
And this is the complex for, I'm going to say it, Puli Mele. Is that it?
Yeah, Puli Mele. Yeah.
Puli Mele.
Yeah.
And there you are, and you are looking around, and a short distance from where you are, you're smack at the base of this pyramidal structure. Now, this, as you describe it, isn't the typical pyramid that we come to know as Egyptian pyramid. It is more like a platform pyramid. Can you describe what you first laid your eyes on? What was it? What kind of a pyramidal structure would you call it?
Yeah, so it's a weird one, because when you're trekking through the jungle, you appear right at the base of the pyramid, and the jungle is
right
all around, you know. So it's really hard to get a perspective on this thing, you know. But it's the whole thing is, imagine a football field. It's about half the size of a football field,
mm-hmm.
And then to the height of a 5-story building, made of black basalt boulders. It's humongous, you know what I mean? It feels massive when you're there, you know?
Mm.
And it kind of rises up to the sky, totally kind of blocks things out. But it itself is covered in the jungle. So, you know, it's all overgrown, and there's, you know, there's trees growing on top, and there's vines hanging down and everything. So it's a really weird feeling to be there, you know? It's not at all like you would expect or like it could be. I mean, the whole monument's been really abandoned, you know?
Right.
So you have this main pyramid structure, which, like I say, is about half the size of a football field. And then to the north of that, you have this smaller pyramid, and the two are connected by a raised walkway, so which is made out of basalt stone as well. So the whole thing is black basalt. Surrounding the whole thing in the complex is a large fitted floor. So like you have at Giza, I've seen this at Giza, where each block of the floor has been cut to fit with the block next to it in a kind of interlocking jigsaw puzzle. And I've seen that any pyramid I've seen, that's the same thing. So if you imagine though this, and that kind of surrounds the pyramid, and then surrounding that are causeways and streets and roads and all sorts of things heading off in the jungle in every direction. And
Would you say that the you've described a little bit about how there's interlocking stones. Would you say that there is a level of precision in what you're looking at in the construction of the pyramid? Or is it more loosely fitted basalt rock that doesn't appear to be cut? Is it more like loose stones that are stacked?
Oh, so the actual pyramid itself is, from what you can see, it looks like loose stones, you know, so they're just kind of smaller stones that are put on the kind of final layer, but inside the blocks are much, much larger. And in 2002, there was an archaeological dig from the Heyerdahl Foundation,
right.
And they found when they excavated that when you went inside the pyramid and right down to where the pyramid meets the bedrock, they're much more work. They're much more precise. They're tabular basalt rocks that are going kind of directly into the ground. So it's kind of tabular basalt and then big boulders, and then the whole thing's covered with smaller kind of river rolled stones. There's no way it looks like it has the precision of like the Great Pyramid, you know, or anything like that. Yeah.
If you were to compare the style of the main complex, could you refer to any known pyramid culture in the Americas or say Indonesia or somewhere else, or is it completely unique?
I think if you've ever seen pictures of Nan Madol, the city, so I think it's more along those lines. It's tempting to say it looks American, proto-American or something like that, but I don't know that would really be correct, you know.
Okay.
Nan Madol definitely. What's interesting is that there are in Tonga, which is maybe 3 days sail to the south, they also have structures they call pyramids, but they're an entirely different fashion. They're built in completely different way. You know, they're they're built from coral, big coral slabs, and then filled with earth. So this is, it doesn't relate to the closest island to Samoa, you know?
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
So what you found out later is that the main complex is aligned to the cardinal points, which is a huge deal, simply because it shows very high-level astronomical knowledge to do that. That's a big structure to do that.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the steps that you discovered? Where are there steps located on all sides or just a couple of areas?
There are steps on the east and west sides of the pyramid, and it is aligned to the cardinal directions, and those steps align with the rising and setting sun on the equinoxes.
Mm-hmm.
And then something I found out, I discovered much later, it's not in the book, but I discovered this quite recently, is, you know, there's an archaeoastronomy piece of software, I can't remember exactly what it's called, it's the same one Robert Bovall uses, but I put the longitude and latitude for Pulemelei in there, and what I realized was that when you're standing in that position, not only can you tell east and west with the rising of the sun, but the Southern Cross, which is something you don't see in the Northern Hemisphere, it's just stars that you see down in the Southern Hemisphere. The Southern Cross is shaped kind of like a diamond, and from Pulemelei, the diamond stands perfectly upright when you're looking directly south.
Hmm.
When that kind of comes to its apogee, you're looking directly to the south. So, I mean, it does mark the, gives the directions, and for me, because Pulemelei, the pyramid, is also surrounded by this massive abandoned city, which was new to me when I got to the island. But there's a massive ancient city around it that makes this Savai much more important in the mythology of all of the Pacific. You know,
you actually discovered that there were an earlier people called the Lapita people, which I believe the Thor Heyerdahl people carbon dated. They were around 1300 BC. But what else do we know about the Lapita group? What did you discover?
Yeah, so the Lapita people are kind of the so they arrived in the Pacific from the west, from which Asia, you know, Indonesia, Asia. Most people say Taiwan is where they came from. They were a pottery making culture. They make these really beautiful decorated pots with geometric patterns on them, and they arrived in the Pacific around about, people think around about 3000 BC. Now they sailed in from the Western Pacific to Papua New Guinea and then the Solomon Islands, and then it's believed they're the first people ever to sail out into remote Oceania, to get past what's called the voyaging boundary, to get past the point where if you sail out, you're taking a voyage of discovery. You can't see the next island, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So they're believed to be the first ones. And there's evidence for them for sure in Samoa. They definitely made it as far as Samoa. There were some pottery shards found when the ferry terminal was getting an update. They were digging and they found all these pottery shards, and because the Lapita pots are so recognizable, they were able to tie this together from Samoa and then thousands of miles to the south all the way to Papua New Guinea. And when they did the dating on the different pottery samples, they found that really to sail from Papua New Guinea all the way into Samoa, at most it took them a few hundred years. So they were in this really explosive state of expansion. And for the longest time, everybody believed that basically the Lapita people got to Samoa. They got there around about 800 BC. And then literally just kind of grew up on the island to become Polynesians, and then sailed out into Polynesia to settle all the other islands in Polynesia.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that came from the Heyerdahl research at Pulemelei is they found out that you have this Lapita people arriving in Samoa, and then a kind of continuous record for them there from 800 BC to about 150 AD, and then they just disappear. It looks like they die out. You know, it really they call it, the archaeologists call it the Samoan Dark Ages. It looks like they either left or they all died out, you know. And then, and then around about 700 AD, you have this new group arriving on the island. And that's what's really fascinating, because that doesn't fit with the accepted version of Pacific history. Everybody thinks the Lapita did the whole thing, but now it looks there's this really fascinating second group arriving in the Pacific just in time to go out and settle all the and the great Polynesian diaspora to go out and settle all the other islands of Polynesia.
I thought your research was quite fascinating because there's no evidence of graves, human remains, or any type of sacrificial ritual any place around the main pyramid. And I was just curious why they didn't find any remains. Was there any explanation for that?
Yeah, it's a weird one. One of the reasons that I think they didn't find anything is that it's like Savai is not great at preserving bones, you know, it's a hot and wet climate. But there is the other reason, I think, is that that's not what they were using it for. Maybe there was an entirely different purpose going on. The reason we didn't find any is because that's not what they were doing there. Although there are a couple of local stories about a 17th century chief who did use that area, did use Pulemele and was a real bad lad, you know, and did sacrifice people, you know. So there are stories there, but they didn't find any archaeological evidence of it, no.
But, you know, it's funny. Pulemele has this energetics about it, and I want to talk about that right now.
Yeah.
And this is something that only recently have we discovered with the Mayan ruins, Mayan pyramid complexes, that they actually built over energetic fields, telluric fields that bubble up during different times of the day. And we don't know how they used it. Now, we know that the last generations use them for seed growth, seed enhancement for their corn, their maize. But when you got to the top of this pyramid, you experienced something quite unusual. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you experienced?
Yeah, this is not like me. I'm not... it's not like me to experience something like this, but so I was on top of the pyramid and I had my compass and I was trying to take some measurements and see exactly how the site was aligned and everything. And I started, first of all, the compass didn't work properly, you know, and I put that down to, well, it's made from basalt and basalt is magnetic, has magnetic properties. And so maybe that explains it. But then a really weird thing started happening is I could see like flashes of purple light and then orange light and just rapid flashing, you know, triggering weird things inside my eye. And it was really disconcerting. And so I sat down, I couldn't really breathe very well. I had it was a horrible feeling, and it's hard to explain now, but a kind of impending sense of doom, you know, like the kind of like, I don't want to use the word possession, but it was horrible. You know what I mean? I thought everything was about to collapse in, you know?
Right.
And as soon as I kind of talked myself out of it, it would just start all over again, the flashing lights and all this kind of stuff. So it was a real physiological reaction to it. And I didn't understand it for the longest time. I had no idea what it was. And then I saw this interview with this guy, John Burke. You must have read his books, eh?
Yeah, that's the top guy right now. He's who I was referring to. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I saw this interview with John Burke, and he was talking about how he'd been at one of those what are they called? Beehive caves in northeastern America?
Yeah, one of the rock buildings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he'd, because, you know, John Burke, it was like a sober guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's not, you know, yeah. And, so he was describing how he spent all day walking in and out of this stone structure. And by the end of the day, he felt thoroughly dreadful. And he described the exact feeling I'd had on top of the pyramid. He thought he was going to die. And this, the way he described it, I thought, I know exactly what you're talking about. And he put that down. He described it as what had happened was he was throughout the day was crossing and recrossing magnetic field lines. And I thought, that's exactly what I was doing as well, you know?
Yeah.
Because the compass was spinning wildly and all that. And something in the magnetic field lines triggers a stress reaction in your body that, you sense as fear, you know?
Exactly. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, what was Bubba doing the whole time, or Baba doing the whole time you were up there? Was he up there with you?
Yeah, he went and hung out. So in the southeastern corner, there's a banyan tree, like a big tree that's grown on the top of the pyramid. Oh. And so he just went and hung out over there, chilled.
So maybe he didn't, because he'd been there so many times, it didn't affect him in the same manner.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I'd never considered that, you know?
Yeah. I just was curious because you were describing this impending feeling of impending doom and paranoia, and I was wondering what the hell Baba's up to. Is he looking at you going, uh-oh, she's freaking out, or...
I've seen this before.
Yeah, maybe he was thinking that, you know, and maybe there's just no way to describe it. What do you think of the electromagnetism of this pyramid, and what does it make you think about what the actual use of the structure was?
Yeah, I mean that's what they used it for that's a big question. I know for sure that, I mean, I sensed electromagnetism up there. That was, but when I dug into the research, there was these guys called Clark and de Biran who I think were also funded by the Heyerdahl Foundation, and they went there in 2010, and they did this really interesting experiment with GPRS where they could look inside the monument, you know, using radar, basically, found out that the magnetic field around Poulemelay is not what they expected it to be. They looked in the reference book, and the reference book told them it should be minus 13 degrees, and what they were experiencing was a magnetic field of plus 10 degrees, which is way off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So they recalibrated their equipment. They started taking these readings with the GPRS equipment, and which kind of fired radar down into the monument, bounced back. They read it. They moved forward 25 centimeters. They repeated this for weeks and weeks and weeks. And when they published their data, what those guys found out, what they showed was that not only is there a strange anomaly at Poulemelay, but at the point where the pyramid meets the bedrock, it's called the mound-ground interface. At that point, there's a reverse polarity, which is like if you've ever held two magnets and pushed them together and felt them push apart, that's a reverse polarity. So they discovered that at a molecular level, as crazy as it sounds, the pyramid floats. Which is just bonkers.
You write about that, and I was just scratching my head when I read that, which means that the people who designed and built the pyramid understood electromagnetics in a way we have no concept for. Now, that pyramid must be doing something. That's a major energetic fault that's producing energy that's coming up and out of the top, probably. And that's why you're feeling those. You're feeling this energy in your body.
Yeah.
And you're being bathed in it, and it's probably overwhelming you. You probably are not supposed to be up there for any long periods of time. I don't know. What do you think? What's your intuition about that?
Yeah, my intuition, if I compare the feeling... So in Egypt, I went to this place... called Philae Temple, and it really caught me off guard. It was dawn, and this place is beautiful at the best of times, but there was definitely an energy there that was just love, you know. That's the only way I can describe it, and it's not like me to say something kind of woo-woo like that, but I remember I came out of there and I had to sit down and I just cried. I'd never experienced anything quite like that, you know. But Poulemelay was the antithesis of that, you know. It felt, for want of a better word, it felt evil, you know. It didn't feel nice, you know. But I do believe that it that it's a technology we just don't understand, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that if you went into like a electricity generating power station today, you wouldn't say, "Oh, I felt love." You'd say, I didn't like that feeling, you know.
Yeah, but you said something very interesting. You called Polemale a power station, and that's something I haven't heard before. And now, you know, maybe that's what this is. It's unseen energy. We don't have technology to measure or to see the energy that's emanating from this, and maybe it's bathing the local atmosphere to do something, you know, or was doing something.
Yeah.
And it's a machine that's not turned off. It's still turned on, you know. That's a fascinating idea.
Yeah, there's some folk tales about people seeing a blue glow over the pyramid and stuff, you know, because it's up on the hills and on a volcano, and people saying that sometimes it kind of, when they said a blue glow, it makes you think electricity and everything. But, of course, electromagnetism is completely normal, you know. Humans didn't invent electricity. We just harnessed it.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, I think it's quite possible. And when you think about the size of the monument, the size of the city that surrounds the pyramid, archaeologists estimate maybe up 50,000 people or more lived in that city, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of people you have to feed. So you mentioned earlier on about using it to treat seeds. It makes sense on a Pacific island that you've got such a massive population. Treating your seeds would make sense, you know.
Yeah, but when Burke said that in his book about the seed propagation, he actually was using that technology in his own company.
Mm.
And if you have to remember, he was on the World Pyramid in Tikal.
Yeah.
When he was measuring the energy coming out of that pyramid. And you don't go build a multi, you know, 100-ton pyramid just for seed propagation. That is the later generations are using that. I think that they use it for a lot of other things that we just don't know about. Human physiology enhancement.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows what else. But
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But when I hear you talk about this, I can only think of Lemuria or Mu technology, and this thing is 100, 200,000 years old or older. What do you think about that? Have you read anything about Lemuria or Mu?
I haven't. I have a friend who's quite interested in it, but it's not really anything. What I did, yeah, I don't really know much about the Mu work. Obviously, I read from, you know, Churchward's Lost Consonant of Mu, but the Lemuria stuff, that to me, like, I haven't looked into it, but to me it makes sense that Lemuria, if it existed, would be Kumari Kandam or somewhere down there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what's one thing that's interesting, actually, in Polynesia they speak, it's called an Austronesian language, you know, it's part of the Austronesian languages, and
mm-hmm.
everywhere in the Pacific, Australia, Samoa, Easter Island, they speak one. It's an Austronesian group, but the other place they speak an Austronesian group is Madagascar, which is just off the southern tip of Africa.
Wow.
Isn't that weird?
That is weird.
And it's just uniquely over there and then in the Pacific.
Wow.
And what sits in between Madagascar and the Pacific is where this place, Kumari Kandan, would have been, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know. I really don't know about that stuff. I don't know enough about it to comment, to be honest.
Yeah. You actually do write about the analysis of the makeup of the main pyramid. And what I was curious about is, did they analyze the interior? I guess they would have to grab a hold of some of the interior stones to see if they were able to amplify some of the geomagnetic energy that was pulsing up into it, because that, to my mind, makes me think that that's a machine. That's an actual pyramid. That's like a machine. What do you think about that? What are your ideas about the geomagnetics of that?
Yeah, well, so they definitely, when you think about where it's constructed, and if you imagine, I agree with you. That's my feeling for it. But
mm-hmm.
if you imagine that you have, you got the part you can see, the pyramid, but then underneath that you have aquifers. So it's built on top of aquifers, which is underground running water. And that in itself has been proven to generate electricity. I don't think the Heyerdahl team looked at any specifically looked at that. I don't think it was until they got their results that they realized there was something electromagnetic going on with the place. But yeah, so if you think you have the pyramid, the part you can see, but then underneath that, inside the ground, you have what are called aquifers, which is water running through rocks underground, and that in and of itself has been shown to generate an electric charge. Now, it's basically as the water squeezes through small holes and then big holes inside the rock, it's put under varying degrees of pressure. And what happens when it goes from a big hole into a small hole is that it's under so much pressure that it actually, for want of a better word, scrapes off an electron from the water molecule, and that electron gets left behind on the rock, and which makes the rock negatively charged, and the water, because it's lost an electron, becomes positively charged, and so electricity streams between those two things, the rock and the water molecule. Mm-hmm. Then underneath that, you have, it's on top of a volcano, so you have heat and energy and noise and all those other kind of things going on, you know. So yeah, I'm pretty sure when you take the volcano and all the noise together, then the aquifers that generate electricity, then you have this weird mound ground interface reverse magnetic thing going on, then on top of that you have a layer of basalt stones in the actual pyramid itself, you have basalt stones, then you have this weird layer of sand which is about 30 centimeters thick, and then on top of that you have more basalt stones, and that just in and of itself starts to make you think about things like a Leyden jar and a capacitor and all those things. If you're thinking in terms of a machine, then it would work as a machine.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
A self-generating machine. Because the aquifers, that's constantly flowing, and it's picking up the geomagnetic field that's probably pulsing up into the pyramidal structure. And then you have the magnetic stone, and it's just amplifying it. So I mean, no wonder you were getting strange vibes and feeling like,
yeah,
because you were getting you were bathed in that stuff.
Yeah, it didn't feel great, you know. I'll say that. I was in, for the longest time, I was in no rush to go back, you know.
Yeah, I can
really
imagine.
Really scared. Yeah.
If you were to kind of sense to who would have built that place, what would be your best guess as to the kind of people that would design a place like that? Because obviously they're a lot earlier than the Lapita people, but we don't know how much earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced that the dating that the Heyerdahl Foundation put on this site is 700 AD. So it's not super, super early, but they found evidence of people there, you know, 2,000 years before that. So
yeah.
But they say that site was built around 700 AD. What I'm convinced is that, I'll tell you what's interesting actually, Cliff, let me put it this way, is that when you look at the Egyptian myths, right,
mm-hmm.
and in the Egyptian myths you have this group, the Shemsu Hor, who around about 3000 BC, they disappear from the story, you know? They leave Egypt, they're gone, right? Now, around about 3000 BC, when you look at the Pacific myths, there is a group that sounds a lot like the Shemsu Hor, around about 3000 BC, pop up in the Pacific, you know? So it's a long bow to stretch, you know, but it's intriguing, you know? But basically, I think that the picture of Pacific settlement is way more complex than anybody has given it credit for. I mean, the accepted model right now is that the Lapita people came from Taiwan, they sailed in the middle of the Pacific, they stayed there for 2,000 years, didn't do much, and then they settled every island in Polynesia. That's roughly the accepted theory. But it's a great time to be looking at stuff in the Pacific, because there's new research coming out all the time. There's this at the University of Otago, here in New Zealand, they have the world's foremost ancient DNA lab. This woman called Professor Matisu Smith is doing this incredible research, and what she's been looking at is the rats that traveled with the Lapita, right? So when the boat sailed, the rats sailed on the boat with them. And then looking at the rats you find in eastern Polynesia, and because she's able to extract ancient DNA, she can get these DNA family trees and build family trees from it. And basically what she's found out is that the rats that traveled with Lapita are not the same rats that end up in Polynesia. So basically, when you look for the rats that end up in Polynesia, they didn't get there with Lapita, which means somebody else was there, you know? And at the moment, that's as far as really anybody gets at the moment, is there is this missing group that isn't in the history books yet, you know?
Fascinating, yeah.
Who they are, we don't know yet, you know?
In your about the author section in your book, you said you're presently writing a Journey to the Heart of a Lost Empire series. Is this the beginning of many books that you're working on in the South Pacific?
Yeah, I hope so. No, yeah. Basically, when I wrote this book, so this is the first three books are already written. I worked with this amazing editor, this guy, Peter Bloxham from London. He's just phenomenal, you know, and he really helped me bring out the story. You know, it kind of reads like an adventure novel kind of thing, but it's full of all the data and everything. And a lot of that's down to Peter, how well I think that story is told. I can't take credit for myself. That was Peter's idea, the Journey to the Heart of a Lost Empire series. And so the first book is really, we realized fairly early on that there's a pyramid on Samoa and no one knows who built it is probably enough of a leap for one whole book, you know? That's enough new news for people to take on, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the second book is really the story of what happened next, which was basically I quit my job. I went sailing around the Pacific trying to find any mention of these people that built this pyramid and definitely found some interesting leads. So the second book is building the case and going on that adventure, building the case for those people. And then the third book is, well, if it was them that built it, then what happened to them? What's their story? Yeah. And then after that, I really want to go to, Peru and Mexico. Yeah. Like you're going there in a few months, is it? You're going to go to Mexico?
Yeah, end of October. It's coming up.
Wow. Totally. That's real soon. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I need to get away for a while. Hey, well, this has been fun. The book is The Samoan Pyramid. My guest has been Maya Lynch. And how can people get a hold of you, Maya? What's your website? What's the detail?
Yeah. It's www.mayalynch.com, which is MayaLynch.com. Mm-hmm. And if they jump over there, put their name in, they get on the mailing list, and every few weeks I send out an email with the latest information about the pyramid, but also about the ancient Pacific more specifically. And
people can also go to Amazon and get the latest copy of the book.
That's right.
Yeah,
I tell you what, it's going crazy, Cliff. I got sent some the details yesterday. It's like number one in all its categories, number one or two in all its categories, and people are reading it, which is really really nice.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's a fun read. It's a really interesting story, and I'm glad you wrote it because it gives us more insight into some of these ancient cultures that have left these ruins. And here you go, you're walking on a ruin that's still activated and it's pulsing this electromagnetic energy. So I'm hoping that somebody listening will go out there with some equipment and stand on top of the pyramid and measure it throughout the day. Because one of the things that Burke discovered is that these pyramids have a daily life cycle. They charge, the energy is weak, and then throughout the day it grows and grows and grows, and then it begins as the sun sets, begins to fade, and then at nighttime it's dormant. So they're kind of like machine-like, natural machines. They follow the cycles of the sun. So
and that kind of makes sense. It's like a culture that didn't, because there was no metals in the Pacific. So a culture that didn't go through the Bronze Age and that kind of thing, they would have thousands of years to perfect their work with stones.
Exactly. Exactly.
It kind of makes sense, you know. And another thing I would say about the fact that they seem so late in the piece. So if the pyramid has been carbon dated to around 700 AD, that shows that these guys were knocking around not that long ago. You know, the last of the ancients was not that long ago.
Which is interesting to consider.
Yeah.
What would you like the reader to get from this? It's a great story. It's written, but what in your mind, what would you like the reader to get away? What would be the takeaway?
Number one, there's a pyramid in Samoa, and nobody knows who built it. Is the main thing, but one thing. But I think the main thing is that at the moment the pyramid is completely abandoned, left to fend for itself. It's the largest monument in the whole of Polynesia, and nobody gives a care for it, you know. Yeah. UNESCO did look at making it a World Heritage Monument a few years ago, but the political situation was too complex, and they said that's that kind of thing, that they couldn't take it any further. But the main thing I would really like is for, one, people to know about it, two, people on the island where it is to know about it, and three, for someone to, for the the political piece of the book, I guess, would be to get the government to start looking after it, which they currently don't.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Maya, thank you for your time. And I really enjoyed talking to you. And I wish more people had the adventurous spark that you have to go out and go it alone with a guide and go find these places.
Yeah, it's been wild. It has been a wild ride. Yeah. Definitely. And if anyone that I would say, anyone that's looking to get adventuring, they should start going on a tour with someone like you, Cliff, you know. It gives you a great introduction to it, you know.
Yeah.
And it's safe, you know.
Yeah, well, where I'm going is not climbing jungles. Although it gets hot and humid in the summer, we're not going in the summertime. I already learned my lesson on there. Maya, thank you very much. I look forward to more of your great books and stories.
I appreciate it, Cliff. Thanks very much for your time. I really enjoyed rambling on at you. Thank you.
Okay. So that was Maya Lynch and the book, The Samoan Pyramid. You can get it on Amazon. It's available to download. I am posting a group of photographs that she has given me. It'll be on the Facebook page. Also automatically posted to earthancients.com. So that's quite an interesting look at a very, very ancient place. I would love somebody to actually use magnometer or a field measuring tool to measure the amount of energy that's coming out of that pyramid, because I think this is the future, is actually beginning to track these energy generators and what their purpose was, and maybe check other locations out to see if the fields that are being generated are similar, have a similar pattern, or if there is a pattern, what this means. So we're still in the infancy in being able to understand what these were built for and what their purpose is. So it's just a big interest of mine too. Next week, we have author Gary David returning with highlights from his new book on Native traditions, understanding the star constellations and what they mean for us today, how they track these constellations. They actually built their cities based on constellations. We know that other ancient cultures around the world did this, but right in our own backyard, those of us who live in the United States, in the southern portion, southwest, can learn more from Gary and his books. So that's next week on the program. So stay tuned for that. Hey, if you want to join me, there's a couple places left for our tour. We arrive October 28th in Mérida, Yucatan, Mexico. We have a 4-star hotel. Then each day we travel to a ruin, and I'll be there with others to tour, to talk about these ruins and some of the most amazing aspects of these places, that you're actually bathed in these buildings. A lot of these pyramids have been turned on again by the elders, and it's really a fun and fascinating journey to ancient Mayan past. If you want to know more about it, go to earthancients.com/tours, and the entire itinerary is available. I've made it quite reasonable. It's half what the typical cost is, and we're going to have a blast. I'm looking forward to it. So come out and join me if you haven't had a vacation or you'd like to see some of the most amazing ruins in the world in Mexico. So come out and hang with me. All right, for that, that's it for today's show. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you next week. Remember, Wednesday is the first of a Earth Ancients special edition, and this is a show that is quite interesting. So I hope you'll join me.